And welcome to Dark Guidance. I'm Tom.
I'm Tom.
I'm Tom.
I'm Tom.
I'm Tom.
And I am also Tom.
All right, good job, team.
Six-man Testament of Menoth squad.
Yes. Speaking of which, we've got Testament Menoth here because we figured today we'd talk to you about the new scenario pack that's dropped as of 2 weeks ago when you listen to this podcast, 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, doesn't matter. It's a podcast that involves talking about Mirage.
Which I definitely know lots about.
Okay, it's the scenario that looks like saggy boobs.
Yeah, I knew that was coming.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Good.
It doesn't look like saggy boobs. not any form of saggy boobs I've ever seen. Okay. You could have gone with lopsided. Like mutated or like broken, I guess.
Undescended.
I'm going to be honest.
Something is wrong.
I think
no, actually, you're right.
Undescended boobs.
It's
singular dropped ball.
Yeah, it's high scrote.
Oh, God.
Tom Scroat is the name of that.
I love it.
That particular scenario from here on in.
Yes. So you could probably tell this podcast.
So to lead us in, to try to bring us back to the norm, just obviously talking about Mirage, how many people think there's going to be an issue with that flag right in the middle of the board trying to put a line of sight blocking piece of terrain that is, say, a building?
How should I put it? In CID, they removed that central flag because of that complaint, and now they just sort of put it back in, and we're all supposed to pretend that it's okay?
Because, fuck it.
I guess.
The scenario becomes less live.
All I'm seeing...
It certainly does. There's always something to contest, right?
Yeah. All I'm seeing is, like, Yarn's talk about Fort Kickass with Thexus happening.
It doesn't become less live. It just means one scenario piece that was not there before is not as live as the rest of the scenario. Because the rest of the scenario is still as live as it was before.
It actually feels more control caster friendly.
Oh, great.
Because your score rate can actually be actively a lot faster.
Yep.
Yeah, which is exactly what they were aiming for with... Yeah. Wait a second.
All right.
Good thing they nerfed all this control.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, so just listeners, there's a lot of us, and more importantly, Tomo is way more sober than I am and has a nice sheet filled with like what appears to be...
scrawled notes and three-dimensional arrows.
Which I'm sure we'll not get to any of.
Something to do with the scenario and how to play you go slightly northeast and then into the page.
Yes.
Correct, and a Spartan helmet.
Yeah, genius.
Yes.
That looks like a Protoss symbol, I'm not going to lie.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So, have we basically drawn a map how to play this scenario? Is that like a treasure map?
Yep.
All the scenarios.
You've got to be moving upwards, not back downwards, forwards, not backwards, swirling, always swirling.
Yes. Except when you play against Magnus.
Yes.
True. Where you can't twirl towards anywhere
and you can't
but
go
sadness.
Backwards or sideways. Pizza pie when you're meant to French fry. That's all that matters.
You're going to have a bad time.
Yeah. Scenario play is about having a good time. When Magnus gets involved, you're going to have a bad time. When Ostrom with seven heavies gets involved in Irregulars.
Seven heavies? Crikey. Yeah.
Jesus.
Do you know how much a basher costs?
Not enough, apparently.
I'm used to them using six or seven or ten gun bunnies instead.
Congratulations, they can bashes are 9 points.
I'm living in the past.
Oh,
yes,
they came up on handguns. Now it's all bashes, buddy.
It's going to hit you today.
So,
basher meta.
Well, here's the problem with it. Bashers can win the game without rolling dice, and, you know, like, bunnies have to roll dice to kill people.
Don't bunnies win the game by not rolling dice, too?
Yeah, but bashers have slams and stuff and all manner of nonsense.
The game that I watched with Keith and Jeff, like, bunnies won the game by pushing Keith 14 inches in completely random directions until he was standing directly in front of Alexia and a entire unit of Hamadors.
Yeah, good people, Ostrom.
Yep.
Yeah, it worked really
definitely.
Well.
Yeah.
It was it definitely made Keith's day. He looked very happy.
I bet.
Alright, Tom, lead us fellow Toms into a discussion about how to scenario.
Thank you, Tom.
So what are we actually talking about? Are we going to talk about scenarios?
If we hadn't already been, we sort of had a preliminary discussion, sort of having a bit of a talk about the impact of scenarios on the way that we build lists and whether or not, or at least exploring the realm of possibility of building lists that are basically designed to be scenario viable more than anything else. So I think from that we had a few different areas that we want to talk about. The first of all is actually looking at what is actually strong at playing a scenario. And by that, I mean actually sort of breaking down what we're talking about with these archetypes of being a scenario-dominant list, what we're seeing at the moment, why they're successful, and how that leans into the current scenario packet.
Yes. So I think the general litmus test to ask is, if you go second against list X, does it feel like you're shoveling shit uphill and the hill is very slippery and the shit's just going to fall right down in your face?
And the floor is on fire and the hill's on fire.
Yeah.
And everything's on fire.
Now, the more adjectives you add to this, the worse it feels. But that's the general litmus test, is going second, does this feel like a auto-lose, basically? Like, is it when you win the die roll against certain lists, you feel like you're morally obligated to go first or else you just get butt-fucked?
Yep. Or is your first instinct when the game actually starts is, all right, how quickly can I kill their car?
So
from my point of view, looking at that scenario packet, there's definitely three scenarios there that I feel that if you go second, depending on if you're up against particular lists that have a lot of swarm. So if anyone recalls my lock and load game against Corridor, we had 56 pikemen.
Still heads.
And rather than obviously you had Magnus too as well, but rather than focus on Magnus, just the amount of guys on the board. If you look at Mirage, if you look at the old Spread the Net, and the other one, I'm sorry, just scrolling through, and Recon, you could have yourself a situation where if you can't even get on their half of the board, it's a sad times because they're just kind of autoscope points. So to lead in, obviously, from the topic that Tom said, I think moving into the next phase of scenario monsters, I see a lot of just swarm lists, particularly if they're hard to remove, if they've got mechanics like Tough, Tough No Knockdown. Obviously, we've seen a fair bit of Gorton do similar type things. I think definitely on half the packet, it's going to be a very viable way to win the game. And initially, I think it's going to get a lot of free auto wins. I don't know how you guys feel, but that's what my initial thought process is.
My first thought when looking at the scenario pack is, if you weren't buying stock in Alexia Futures before, it's time to do so now. Like, Alexia has been nerfed, and she isn't quite as crazy as she used to be when you used to be able to casually apply buffs to her, but when you get down to it, she creates solos, she creates contesting models, so defensively she is incredibly strong, because she stops you just randomly auto-losing, or more importantly, on an attrition perspective, having to contest with real models.
Yeah.
And defensively, like, if you... Here's an example. Take Haley 3 Gravediggers. You know, classic list. Sometimes has Iona, sometimes has Alexia. If you play that list in Mirage and you have Alexia, you go from having, you know, a decent game, we're all playing, it's very solid and blah, 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 you know, very, very gentlemanly like sport to, all right, well, we're still the same thing, except that I always contest your zone every turn. You have to put a real model onto my zone to contest. And also, if you fuck up and don't leave enough models next to your flag, one Thrall Warrior is going to run straight over there and score. The danger of a lot of these scenarios is when you use pieces like Alexia, and there are other pieces that do so too, or casters, Dreamer, for instance, making Phantasms to do much the same thing, and then going like, cool, I'm 3 points up.
Yeah.
There are certain lists, like Mirage is a big, big offender, because you could be playing, say, Nemo 3. Nemo 3 could be a scenario master genius and go, I score my zone with myself, I feed, I kill every model that's contesting all the flags, which seems unlikely until you consider it's Nemo 3, so possibly not super unlikely. Certainly not if they hadn't nerfed his Electro Leaps. I kill your objective, bam, 5 points.
Yeah.
Now, that's quite unlikely, but what's more likely is he goes, okay, I score my flag, I score my zone, I score the middle zone, or I kill your objective. I'm up 3 points, I've contested your stuff, and I haven't popped my feet yet. What do you do?
Probably he takes middle zone and doesn't kill the objective, right? So then he's up 3 points, and all he really needs to win is
to kill your objective
and score 1 point.
Yes.
Which is basically unstoppable. Like, yeah. It's going to be extremely difficult for you to stop him scoring from there.
So, and this is Nemo 3, who's not really a scenario of master genius.
Yeah, I mean, the same logic applies to almost any list that can, on demand for one turn, put out a huge amount of damage.
Yes.
So any list, which is, I kind of find it interesting that if a scenario is live enough, then lists that aren't really scenario lists can become scenario lists simply by virtue of the fact that lists that can generate a huge amount of damage on one turn, but then that's their turn. Assyria would be a good example.
Yep.
Those lists become a scenario list in a sense because you only need to clear for one turn, right? Like, you just need one turn where if you get up 3 or 4 points, that's basically game. You don't need enough carry to get through the end of the game because all you got to do is clear one zone and destroy an objective, and that's it.
Yeah. Gas isn't output, it's just presence at that point, which is a big... That feels like a big shift in the way the game plays.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be, like, Mirage. Like, you could do the same thing on, like, Standoff, for instance. You can kill their objective, score your flag... Sorry, score your zone and score one of the two circular zones... Which is not super crazy to do, and just go up 3 points, and then you can dangle that over your opponent basically the whole game and force them to overcommit models to get into your zone, to just try and figure out ways to stop you from randomly contesting this, so they can put points back on the board.
Yeah.
And then we get into people like Tom Whaley.
Yes.
How do you feel about Gatsby 3 in certain of these scenario packs and scenario zones? Because I can tell you a list that really feels garbage to go second against, and it seems to be like a Nine Slayer kind of build, maybe?
Yeah, well, anything that can sit on the 25-inch line at the bottom of, top of one seems pretty good.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah, I think anybody can argue with that.
I really don't think anyone can.
Any time where if you're going second, you know that you have to do something extraordinary to be able to walk out of your own deployment zone without dying, that's a bad place to be.
Or an average place to be when you're playing against Krix.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just Krix.
So probably leading into that, what do you think about the whole going first, going second scenario? Going first, going second situation in the current pack. I know from my experience coming back overseas, obviously I don't know how you felt, Colin, but the times that I went first, it was not much of a game at all, particularly obviously we highlighted Nine Slayers. Mm. So I suppose from my general feeling is that going first is... And I'm not sure if it's just because of the state of play of the scenario or maybe just the type of list that we're seeing at the moment, but I think going first, in my opinion, is a massive advantage. There are a few cornerstones where I think going second is okay, but yeah, going first to me seems like it is way out in front, or almost a no-brainer when you win that dice roll, whereas probably a few years ago that's what it used to feel like, and I know they're obviously trying to take big steps to bring that closer together, but I think my feeling is it's blown back out again.
The only way I can see them ever actually fixing that is a suggestion that is so bonkers that I don't think they could ever touch it, which would be to say, all right, the line of sight blocking piece of terrain, you get it. If you go second, you get to choose where it goes. Place it anywhere on the board. Your call.
Damn.
That's more than any theme is willing to give you, right?
Yep.
And that's a big way to change scenario.
Massive advantage to the person that goes second.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Well, they're already themed to give almost that ability. It's just not as far up at the board.
Nowhere near as big.
And it's not as relevant.
Two clouds 20 inches up the board is pretty...
Yeah, but it's not...
Clouds at 20 inches up the board doesn't actively help you score into aggressive scenario control.
Well, you don't know what the piece will be, right?
Sure.
So I guess...
Sure.
And I don't know how you would balance it, but I think that that's the kind of level of advantage you would need to give to the person going second to make it offset what currently you get for going first.
Yeah. As a counterpoint, I think the lists that you can go second with and feel okay with are really tanky lists that also have the ability to contest. So the one that really comes to mind for me is Dreamer.
Hmm.
Dreamer loves going second and will prioritize going second because Dreamer can contest your zones with Phantasms. As long as she kills anything, she's good for that. And as a result of that, she can take advantage of the fact that she gets a score first. Plus, it's Dreamer, right? She doesn't want to, like, go crazy and expand out. So she can just walk into the Threat Rings of the Slayers and thunder her nose at them, if so choose. Assuming you do it correctly, of course. If you just walk into the Threat Range of Slayers,
you're going to get Slayers.
Have a bad time.
Well, but you can... You can
French fry instead of pizza, right?
Yeah.
But I think that like Dreamer is a really good example of a particular archetype that you could look at for this scenario play. And she wants to go second, and I think there's a combination of tankiness and also, I mean, depending on how much value you're putting onto it, and I'm thinking of Ryan in this example, but aggressive displacement effects feels like a really strong tool to have if you're okay with going second.
Also advanced deployment or advanced move.
Yes.
Either of those two will allow you to go second way more comfortably.
Yeah.
Because if you have anything that stops your opponent literally running their max distance to get to just outside of your threat range on top of one,
yeah,
then you're in a much better spot if you have anything at all.
Yeah.
Otherwise, that. Why then Gatsby gets to play the Gatsby, for instance, as our like counterpart, but also someone like Ostrom gets to play the game of like, I'm going to be literally just outside of your threat range, but you have no choice but to move forward or lose. And if you do move forward, you probably still lose anyway.
Mm.
Whaley, in your game with Pat, did you win the dice roll?
I did not, and he chose to go first. And the reason why is just to probably counter what some of you guys have just said, but he saw the issue and needed to go first to get board presence.
What was the scenario?
He had to. The scenario was the pit two.
Right.
See, I can definitely understand that Dreamer would want to go second into some cases.
Yeah.
But into cases like Nine Slayers.
Yeah.
And into anything with threat ranges that far up the table and that can reach that long. Dreamer doesn't like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why Abby 2 is still considered one of the bad matchups for the faction.
Yes.
Aggro fast and fast.
Fast attack. Right. Because
something that can hit hard and kill skin and bones before you have a chance to use it is really bad for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's the scenario I was thinking of when I played against Dreamer and she windmill slammed going second was the standoff.
Mm.
And it's because Dreamer loves that friendly zone and can generate contesting models for days to get into your zone.
Mm.
But it has to be a situation like that. Like back in the day, Erosk 2, I really liked. I could go second there because I could just tank a lot of things, which meant that aggressive threat ranges were less meaningful. This is obviously a different era of the game, but that's the kind of list you really need. You need something that can take a punch to a really. Well, more importantly, not just take a punch, but also, even if you get stuck in a jam, be able to contest your opponent's zones.
I think the problem is more that it's dependent on what your opponent's list is.
Yes. Like,
so the only times I will consider going second are if my opponent cannot put something so far up the board that I can't advance. So if I can still run turn one, even if I'm only running 2/3 of my full run, then I might consider going second. But if they can get into range to threat 12 inches to my deployment zone, then I can't go second.
Like if I see... like Band of Heroes, most Band of Heroes lists, if I see Iron Fangs, if I see like not fast but like even medium speeded melee tank lists
breaks,
it doesn't even have to be a brick, it just has to be, even if it's just bodies, if they're not projecting, then you're just like, well, I'll take the scenario advantage and that's great. I can live with it.
But
a lot of lists that you're seeing right now in the meta are things that are, I'm going to project a billion inches,
which is for that exact reason, right?
Exactly.
So that's the reason Gorton's got press gangers and stuff is because they can get up the board.
Well, it's also, even if Gorton goes second, so this is a Gorton slash... Also, Magnus can play this list as well, and oftentimes will. But basically, you take a shit ton of Steelheads, Press Gangers, and Elixir. And the reason you do all that is because you have just a whole shit ton of dudes. But the Press Gangers give you AD, which means that even if you go second, you've got projection. Yeah. Plus, they natively have Tough. In Gorton's case, he has Steady, or Solid Ground, I should say. And in Magnus's case, he's got his feet to lock people in place. But because you've just got advanced moving bodies, not only can you make a more compact formation, because you can literally deploy them right in front of your army, you don't have to deploy wide, because you can deploy just narrow like a giant column. But also, you can use those to, if they come, they can't just, you know, run to, you know, just outside of 11 inches of a bunch of steelheads, for instance, or whatever your threat range happens to be. It's funny you also say displacement effects, because I think that's the big table flipper, is if you do have something like that that just flips the table, or just, you know, like Ron's TK effects, but also going to Gorton, but Gorton's feet. Yeah.
Cold Grimmar
as well.
Yeah. Bulldoze.
It's own problem, but I mean, like, that feeds straight into the problem of it's doing exactly that threat projection up the board, but then it's also got the displacement, which is why we're like, I don't know about the rest of the world, but we're shitting bricks in this country at the moment about how to deal with that particular list.
Basically a combination of like Osram with a bunch of heavies and irregulars, taking advantage of the deployment advantage you get from irregulars team, i.e. Heavy advance move, to either, in the case of Magnus 2, just get all of his nomads and stuff up the table. They have access to escort, I believe.
Yep.
Not mobility, they get escort. Yep. So, therefore, they're already 5 inches up the table, then they run like 12, so they're 17 up. They're actually probably comparatively about as far as a Slayer would be.
Yep.
And you've got Magnus. And you've got Magnus right behind it. Or Atelli.
So, do we have any advice for those that say, you know, thinking about list building or thinking about some of those other factions that don't have AD or don't have +2 inches on deployment. And like I said, do they really seriously have to think about their list selection against these top lists that we're talking about, so that so they just don't auto-lose? That's kind of my feeling. Cool. If you don't have those tools and you don't win that, like, it seems to me it's pretty big risk to put... I mean, I know this is obviously, probably extreme, but the thought of, if I don't win this die roll, I've pretty much auto-lost this game.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Most factions have something. Either you have to take something that projects far with ranged or with melee of some sort, something that you can throw something at. Most factions have a list or a caster that can do that. But, I mean, they're also building it into themes. Mm. So, like we've seen in Manowar, for instance, in the most recent one, and into Wintergard, you're seeing, because they're generally considered slow-moving armies, they're actually built in to have aspects that allow pieces to move up the table, so they are projecting or more relevant to scenario in a lot of lists.
You have a lot of themes that just have mass advanced move. For the Caedor perspective, that's actually Wolves of Winter, where it's all the Doomreavers advanced move, and you can basically advanced deployment, and therefore you basically can, you have apparitions, so if someone tries to jam you with Slayers, you then counter by apparating and charging them on top of one.
So you might not have AD.
I wouldn't recommend anyone to do anything that involves Doom Reapers.
Well, that agreed.
Yeah, if the alternative is losing literally the die roll and therefore losing the game.
But it's not, because you could play Manowar and you can have a chariot walk 7 inches for free at the beginning of a game.
Yep. Sure.
And that is completely unmolested and you're probably still out of most threat ranges of things.
Yeah.
And then it's free to do whatever it wants after that, having started 17 inches up the table.
But I heard somewhere on the internet that said that list is completely unplayable, though.
Caedor? Yeah, we could tell. You've probably heard that on this cast, Dark Guidance. And one of the many Toms on this cast has probably told you that at length. But more realistically, you do have... Like, don't ever feel bad about playing something if it gives you a chip and a chance against a list like a scenario jammer, because you do need it. You need to change how the game works when you're dealing with that kind of shit. Yeah.
That's actually a really important concept, is if you try to play the same game into those lists, then you end up in a 50-50 on who gets first turn.
Yeah, so to elaborate, the lists we are talking about are... Nine Slayers is the most popular example of this, but it's basically any list that can project such a huge turn one run and occupy board space threat.
Yep.
Typically will involve a lot of heavies or a lot of AD models. For instance, the example I was going to use to counter Doom Reavers is, for instance, Mage Hunter Strike Force.
Sure.
Mage Hunters going first is terrible if you're a gunline, if you're running Assyria, because what will happen is the Arcanids will get into all the best spots and they'll hide, and they'll make sure that if you come forward to try and deal with any of the Mage Hunters, you're going to be blinded.
You're prepared for a game of lockdown.
Exactly. And you're going to spend... You're not going to shoot until turn three at least.
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, you have to deal with this kind of skew. Now, Retribution isn't the most suited for this, until possibly random CID changes happen. But even without that, they're still not the most suited for that, but it's still going to be... That would be more of an attrition style of play. But that being said, if you can't shoot and you're a gun line, like, say, McKay Trains, and you can't punch because everything's AD and it's all spread over the table, so being able to actually engage it correctly is super hard, then you're in for a real bind, and they might just win scenario off the back of, well, you can't contest the friendly flag and this friendly zone and all a bunch of other stuff. So,
so I think that's...
McKay Trains might be, like, a really terrifying scenario list. Well, like, especially with that faction giving, like, that tier where you get +2 to go first, you're almost always guaranteed to go first, and then you get to put, like, massive guns at the...
Thank you, actually, for bringing out one of my other points I would be talking about, Tom. Actually told Tom as well. Advantages to go first.
Advantages to going first?
Sorry, like +1 or +2 to go first is fucking huge.
Yes.
It's actually one of the reasons I think Gravediggers, no matter what happens, is always going to be a pretty solid list, because even if it's playing the Slayer spam, it's got a 60x% chance of just, at least going first. And having 80 models, so it doesn't immediately get blown out.
And I think that, like, the getting first and playing into particular archetypes is, like, one of the lists we haven't really talked about is Primal Terrors.
Yes.
And I think getting, if you've got any form of competent gun line that sort of can ping out some of, the, like, those linchpin pieces, like your Hellmouths, or your, like, what solos they're bringing, or even, you know, chipping into a fair chunk of a particular unit, I think that puts that list at a massive disadvantage playing them. And whenever I've seen it lose games, like myself playing or watching it, particularly like OTC, like it was always going down to lists that could just deny its ability to get up the board and play like a grind out scenario game.
Yeah. Because a lot of the times it wants to get the melee into a spot away from the zone, so it just casually wins and forces you to... You're already wasting a lot of models fighting Primal Terrors because it's fucking terrifying at how effective it is at actually milling melee pieces. But then if you go like, okay, you have a friendly zone you have to contest and you can't contest your zone is like basically off limits because a Hellmouth tentacle is running to it every turn. So you have to kill a unyielding tentacle, which might have an armor buff because, you know, why not? That Primal Terrors is not a scenario list, but it plays, it abuses a lot of the scenario aspects to gain a nutritional advantage, which we've sort of talked about a couple of times, but it is more, it isn't really like an abuser so much as a user of the scenario pack.
Yep.
It just uses it for the wrong things.
Yes.
Well, that's a symptom of Hellmouth, though.
Yes. Yeah, but even without that, like the fact it has a Blightbringer, the Blightbringer is naturally in good spots to basically contest friendly zones.
I almost never see the Blightbringer getting from that far forward.
That's the thing.
But it's not contesting it then.
It's the one that's controlling it. So in the zones where you have the two rectangles in the circle in the middle, for example, it will sit in that rectangle while touching also the circle and with dudes in front of it.
And unlike a lot of pieces that were basically, you know, they have to get up the board or have to leave that zone to be relevant, like the Blightbringer can just shoot something and then it provides its aura that far upfield.
It gets its value by existing.
Yes.
Yeah. As a gigantic sweet potato with teeth.
Just soaked in marshmallow.
So, for it, I mean...
It's just the candied yam of Legion.
Yeah. gives presents to all the good ogres. So, for instance, let's just take Primal Terrors on, say, like, Spread the Net. A very common situation is that your friendly zone is going to have a Blightbringer in it, and then the central zone is going to have the Warcaster in it, especially a Warcaster like Thagrosh or Kallus, who have an aura buff that they can...
Or the other part of the Blightbringer.
Triggerbird?
Normally Blightbringer 6. Just a whole bunch of dudes in front of it. You can't get in either zone. You can't take either zone, and the flag's got Thagrosh or someone else standing next to it, or a Mock or some other idiot.
And good luck getting to that Blightbringer to stop it from scoring.
And then your zone has fucking 14 Ogryn in it.
Then you kill Triggerbird, and Triggerbird goes back.
Yes.
Play for another game.
Even worse, it's just like, you've got a friendly flag, right? Well, not really, because the Hellmouth is usually just putting it... The other Hellmouth is usually just putting a tentacle next to it, just going, hi.
So I think there's... We've kind of got onto the track of just what happens when people go first against you. And there is a major, I guess, I don't know if problem. Problems were probably a bit too strong. There is certainly an issue in the game for players if you are going second with a list and your list can't take a serious punch in the face.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically that's going to be the criteria, is if you don't have some way to either avoid a punch in the face, so something like a Rask feat or some sort of a feat that stops them coming towards you or stops them being able to do what they want to do.
Or produce one.
Yeah. So you need to either... Well, so I'll get to produce, because produce is another problem. So the first issue is, if you have a way to bypass the damage they're threatening to do for a turn, then you're going to be feeding modern one, and that's going to happen to you a lot. If that's okay, which for some lists it is, then you can still play a game. If you have a feat that produces huge amounts of damage, then you have a different problem, which is if you commit to feeding bottom of one to kill all of their shit, you're still not in the scenario.
No. Yes.
Because you've had to stand still and shoot, or walk forward slightly and shoot. And as a result, they then get a turn where if they've got enough left, they charge into you, and now you can't get into the zones anymore, and then they score.
So they have a powerful feat that prevents movement.
Correct.
or you're, and basically, your soul is trying to get to a point where you're playing, like you're trying to create the conditions of a fair fight on scenario.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is not really what you want to be leveraging, like your most powerful mechanisms in the game to do.
Yep. You don't want a feat to get to parity. Like that's not the point of a feat.
No.
And that's the thing, right? You're feeding to not have gone second.
Yeah.
That's what you're basically doing.
Yeah, pretty much.
And that's what I do with Rask all the time. If Rask goes second, then quite often I feat to not go second.
I'm the same with Ryan. Like, you know, enough pushback will just generate you board presence that's relevant, right?
Yeah. And then you've just got to hope that the natural benefits, in inverted commas, of going second, in terms of scenario advantage, in theory, is enough to then get you back into the game when they inevitably feat the following turn, and you're now playing second fiddle to someone else's control feed.
Because the funny thing is, if the game does go on for the long, like for the rest of the,
Then you get back to something.
Not just that, you actually, like, if you can manage to survive the initial scenario blitz and blowout for whatever list it is, you actually do have a pretty huge advantage going second because you score last.
Yeah, you're not in a bad spot. It's certainly,
but you have to, have a list and a design in mind to how to get to that spot. Because
getting to turn seven is a difficult plan.
Well, I mean,
if you're playing into Gatsby Slayers, if you make it turn seven, you've won the game.
Yes. Pretty much. But it's also like, if the game probably won't go to turn seven, because if Gatsby Slayers, or frankly a lot of lists, see that they're in a bad spot, they'll pull the trigger on something. They'll go for a suboptimal assassination because the alternative is literally just losing automatically.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely an interesting thing to look at with a lot of these scenario dominant lists, is that 9 times out of 10, they've also got that back pocket shovel that, like, at worst, kind of consistent.
Yes.
And that's something that really needs to be factored in when you're looking at the concept of building a list that's generated to play scenario, is that it has all the tools to also ensure a quick close out of the game in another
action,
whether that be a damage production feat or trigger, or the ability to just flat out kill a caster.
You should be able to coup de grace the game.
Yes.
Like, either whether that comes in the form of killing their caster or going for a big turn where you clear all three flags and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, Gatsby's, if you want. So we've talked about Gatsby a fair bit, and Whaley, you can chime in here because you are the notorious Gatsby abuser. There's even a meme on you online.
Oh, really?
There is a little meme, yes.
Beautiful one, too.
Yeah, I think you are 100% correct. I think we've covered it very, very thoroughly about, you know, all those advantages for that Crix player going first, or all those lists, all those archetypes that are going first. I just think it's probably worth, in terms of thinking about, is it worth people when they're building lists to, you know, and things that obviously come to mind, things are like Machine Race or Gremlin Swarms or Feral Geists, or, you know, fast incorporeal models that can try to, you know, hold zones or delay the scenario, in the sense of if you're in a situation where you're playing against this type of list, you go second, and, you know, you think to yourself, and you don't have a defensive feat that can allow you to mitigate that fact. You know, basically, if you don't have any of those tools, you know, should you be thinking about, okay, how am I going to play into this game? Or is the thought process, I hope I don't hit 9 slayers today, and if I do, I hope I don't lose my die roll to go first.
Yeah.
Which isn't that terrible odds, right? Like, if you're going into a tournament and your thought process is, well, I hope I don't hit Crix. Okay, it's a 4-round tournament. There's a pretty good chance you'll hit Crix. Let's call it 50% chance you're going to hit Crix once for the day. Maybe 60 or 70.
Yep.
Then let's say, okay, I hope if I hit Crix, I don't hit Gatsby 3. All right, let's say 50-50 shot at best. So we're down to 35% chance that we hit Gatsby 3 at some stage during the day. And then we say, all right, I also want to win first. And if I win first, I think I've got a game.
Hmm.
So now you're really talking 17% chance that this goes wrong for you for the day.
And
which is not terrible, right? Like, it's not great.
Furthermore, you also have to ask yourself, who actually is playing List X in your current in meta? Because it's really easy to get... No, you're...
You're not in our meta, it's fine.
Yeah.
We've got too many Toms in this fucking meta.
Yeah. This meta... Yeah, we need to clean some of the...
No, it's fair, but then, okay, I totally agree with those statistics, but what if then you've got to factor in, because it's a similar type thing, you've got say, Gordon, then you've got to factor in, say, Magnus, then
yep.
you've got to factor in, like we saw, obviously, Makeda 2 with 30 swordsmen. Now, obviously, she's not necessarily...
50 swordsmen, not 30.
Well, the one we saw had 30.
Okay, but, well, that was a low tier list. It
wasn't trying
It was not trying hard enough.
Oh,
but the understanding of these type of lists, whereas in, okay, you know, if you add those layers of, if I hit this list and I go second, you know, what type of chances do I have? And therefore, should I be trying to factor in, you know, ways that I can have some kind of game in this? And that's either, you know, obviously we touch a little bit about, you know, lists that have potentially an overwhelming turn of damage output, or this is the other route, potentially, you know, ways to prolong this scenario, obviously depending on what faction you play, depending on what tools you have available. Yeah.
From
my point of view, that's definitely the path that I'm going down currently. You know, thinking about these lists or thinking about these builds. Surprised no one. I love Nine Slayers, but Nine Slayers I'm putting on the shelf for a little while, and I'm going down the path of exploring these other type builds and these other type lists. You know, not that I'm producing anything that's any more nice to play into, but certainly thinking about you know,
future ways to oppress people. I agree.
Well, and you're obviously a big contributor to that, Chris, because every time I'm doing something and you're saying that's a really good list, I'm like, this is fantastic. So
okay,
you have part to blame.
So you're saying the odds of me running into Slayers have just dropped from 17.5% to, say, 6%, maybe 7%?
I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Well, yes.
Winifon sounds really fun right now.
Yeah.
If you hit me in 2 weeks, Colin, the chance of running a 9 Slayers is 0%.
So. Excellent. That's fantastic. What I like to hear.
Uh-huh.
I
think, that sounds like a bit of a ruse. Let's not.
Well, I think Whaley hit a really interesting point there.
It's 8 Slayers and Cankerworm.
No, it's actually 18 Slayers. You'll notice both lists are in fact 9 Slayers. It's just the second 9 Slayers list is another caster that clearly has a meta role, but it's though. It's just to get 18 Slayers on the table. Go on.
I think Whaley brought up a really interesting point there about having tools to play against to play scenarios with particular lists, and I think that actually, like, your Scar list, Whaley, definitely embodies the inverse of that, which is having tools that make it really difficult to bring a particular strategy against a list to play into it on scenario.
Yeah.
In terms of the fact that you've got 20 Banes of various assortments, like everyone's just super happy to see those fuckheads on the table, but then you bring a couple of Wraith Engines and a few Incorporeal Solars, and all of a sudden, like, my game plan becomes totally disjointed, incoherent, and like, to be blunt, schizophrenic, because I don't know which direction I need to point first, because everything's about to come at me, and I need to adapt to killing everything at once in order to play this viable game. But, like, I really struggle to think of any list in the game that really do that super effectively.
Actually, I can give you one. It's also Crixlist. It's kind of like the Gorshade 2 builds, which involve a lot of cav. Sure. And the reason why is they can just throw models away.
Yeah.
As long as they don't lose the last member of their cavalry units, you'll have a full unit of cav to go back.
Yeah.
So therefore, you can buy into the alpha by just accepting it in the face, because you were able to return back with cavalry, and they've presumably blown a bunch of things or put models in threat range for you to kill.
That's why I'm super excited to see Morvana 2 get a little bit of a relook at, because I think...
I'm not. Colin,
I am so glad I came to play Broken Shields.
It'll be fine. It'll all be fine.
Colin, can I borrow your Morvana for a bit?
Colin, you can borrow my one. It was just the same.
But yeah, recursion strats are really good. As we elaborated on earlier, Alexia is really important, or models like Alexia, because they generate ways of contesting or not having to play into the scenario game. Anything that allows you to cheat is good.
Yes. Not playing fair is definitely the way to win.
Because let's be honest, right? The scenario abusers are not playing fair, so don't try and play fair into them. That's just a fool's game.
That's a super strong point. So here's something that I've been thinking about a lot, and it was something that came up because lots of people had conversations with me about specifically the Rask list that I play that doesn't have any units in it. And a lot of people would talk to me and go, hey, but you don't have a unit and you can get Swamp Gobbers and that makes the whole problem go away. So I agree with the concept that you want a plan for how you're going to play on scenario. I disagree with the concept that the only correct plan for how to play on scenario is to play to win by scenario.
Mm.
So
it is necessary to have a plan to stop your opponent winning on scenario. That has to happen, because otherwise, if you run into someone whose plan is to win on scenario, you've got a real problem. It is not necessary to have a plan to win on scenario yourself any more than it is necessary to have a plan to win by assassination or necessary to have a win by attrition. You must have a plan for stopping opponents from beating you, and you must have a plan for how you are going to win. Those two things need to exist in your list. Everything else is superfluous. Everything else is optional. So if you're playing into a list that you know plays for scenario and it wins on scenario, you need a plan for how to not lose on scenario. And then you need to trust that whatever your normal plan for how your list will win will work if you can give it enough time to work, because you're not losing on whatever their condition is for winning.
Most gun lines abide to this philosophy.
Yep.
Most gun lines I know that are successful have a plan to aggressively, very aggressively, not lose on scenario.
Sure.
Not to win on scenario. It's to basically move up and then back up as best as they can.
Which could mean getting up 3 points, right? Like, sometimes those lists will get up 2 or 3 points and then will not win on scenario.
Yeah, they'll basically go...
The strategy of, I will never lose by five.
And like, I'm in a position where you have to throw things away to stop me from winning on scenario, even though I have no intention of ever winning on scenario.
Yes.
If you win... attrition so fast and it never comes into play.
Yes. Yep. Like, if you want, like, it's the Frawley method. It's just like, I could win on scenario by going for some sketchy play, but how about I just
farm kill points first?
Yeah,
I could just kill these other five of your dudes and then let you have a turn where you have to flail around trying to stop me winning on scenario, and then I kill five more of your dudes, and then and so on and so forth until such time as I either accidentally win on scenario because my caster hasn't moved for four turns, or I win because you've run out of models.
Yep. Now, into that and into leading into what you just were talking about, Colin, specifically with regards to not having to take units, I think of when you look at the scenario packs, and the scenario pack is divided in such a way that you have Jaxa control square zones as well as battle engines, you have units to control circular zones, and you have solos to control flags. And of all of those three elements, units are the least valuable of them, I find.
Because theirs have the easiest zone to contest.
And they're the most difficult to score with.
They're also the
very much
elements to remove, by and large.
So therefore, you also have a situation. You also have to always keep this in mind that your caster, you can always score with face, i.e. your caster. And getting your caster into a 12-inch circle is way easier than getting him onto a flag.
Yes.
One puts you literally on a flag, and the other, like, if your opponent is pre-registered to assassinate you if you get on that flag, well, then you're just dead. Most zones have terrain in them, though. If you get into a zone to control it, then said zone will basically, you know, give you at least some protection.
Good job, Kat.
All right. We have another Tom who's joined us. It's Tom Cat. Tom Cat. Anyway. And the second, squares are not relevant because every list has warjacks or war beasts. But they kind of are, because sometimes you just need to commit. Like, this is actually one reasons I think having a solo colossal list is a problem, or can be a problem, is because sometimes you need your colossal to, like, go and fight other colossals or just beat other beasts up.
Actually earn its points.
Yes. Correct. And a lot of times it can't do that.
Very difficult.
It can't be do. It
while
can't...
standing in its own zone.
Yes.
Come to me, but don't kill me.
Yeah.
Seems like a really easy game to play.
Yep. There are a couple of ones that can do it, like the Helio.
Anything with Ron, right?
Anything that can bring it to you.
Well, like, not even just anything with Ron. Anything with the placement effects or just really strong gun lines. Like, a Hurricane can do it because the Hurricane is designed to shoot other heavies off the table.
It can get its points while standing in a zone 16 inches away from the thing that it's shooting
at. Most War Machine 14. Factions have a colossal. Capable of sitting back in its home square and just shooting at the opponent's list.
Yeah.
Yes.
The Horde's Gargantuans have a harder problem.
Unless you're...
Nonsense. The Storm Raptor is amazing.
I was going to say, Zapdos is where it's at.
Perfectly fine sitting in the zone. It's never going to the melee.
Right up until the moment it dies. Worth it.
Yeah.
But to be, like, serious, and not saying that the Storm Raptor isn't serious, but also not saying that it is the Glacier King is definitely the dude that feels like...
Yeah.
That guy is...
What is it, then?
Sorry?
The Storm Raptor?
Yeah.
I have gotten it gone poorly every time it go into the melee. Like, one time it went into...
It's funny, Matt 5 does that.
You mean Matt 7 like, with Primal?
Oh, what?
No.
Your Storm Raptor's dying anyway, like, don't pretend it won't, because, you know, you're just lying to yourself then. And you really want to have that on your conscience.
God, yeah, I don't think I've...
I rolled it once, and then I almost killed a Skinner Moon.
Sounds right.
Oh, that was the saddest thing I've ever heard.
All right.
That's not the saddest thing I've ever heard. Not even the saddest thing I've heard about Stormhaven. It's in the top five sad things I've heard about Stormhaven experiences.
Oh, man.
No, it was like in the UK. He was playing the Dreamer, and then there was a skin of us. There was, like, corpses. And then there's a gremlin swarm next to it. And I was like, all right, I guess I'll primal this bird and try to kill it.
Oh, with a gremlin swarm.
Bible strat.
Matt 4.
You needed sevens.
Oh, my God.
You needed sevens, Tom. You were never going to make that work.
You needed to headbutt it with your bloody storm raptor.
What are initials?
Not necessary. You were missing them anyway.
Yeah, but, like, the issue is...
there are many issues, but go on.
In threat range. So if I don't send it in, he would just kill my army. So the raptor has to go in. And then it died to, like, half of a cage rager.
Could you give it magic weapons so that the electroleaps killed the gremlin swarm?
Does that even work?
I don't know.
No, it doesn't work, though.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Work
no, it doesn't.
No, pass that it up so the only electroleap going to is the cage ragers.
Awesome.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Actually, talking about unlikely plans...
Because it's not good in melee.
And talking about unlikely plans, one thing I think people really underestimate these days, if you are just buttfucked like this, and you're in a bind where you need to go and just pull something out because you can't... You have
butt
to...
that's being fucked.
Well, you can't...
Man, who wrote that? Was it Shakespeare?
I think it was Shakespeare that once said, "When thou art being butt-fucked, and thou reallyest need to remove from thine butt something to get thine out of a bind."
And that something is assassination. Because let's be honest, if the game is going to end next turn...
Assassination has ass as his first three words.
Yes!
Perfect. Oh my God, is that being butt-fucked? You
like,
butt-fucked.
You do a quick reversal. But that's the thing, right? If the game is going to end next turn because they're going to go up 5 control points or whatever, you need a plan shovel. And you need a plan shovel right away.
You need a plan shovel 5 minutes ago.
Yes. But that's the thing. You can make...
2 turns ago.
2 turns ago. But on the other hand, you can set it up such that if you have... This is an advantage to having casters like Ron, for instance, where... Or, honestly, like, any shooting assassination caster where, look, if you're going to get blown out on scenario like this, at least be able to keep them honest. If your opponent is good, your opponent will basically have to not play as all-out aggressive, because otherwise they will just lose. And if your opponent isn't good, then you win. There is a caster that sort of... And this is actually one of the reasons I think Ostrom is so strong, is that Ostrom can ignore all of this because he's fucking Ostrom, and he's going to be invincible on the turn he's blitzing you. But most other casters who are trying this play, honestly, a lot of them do not have this luxury. And it's something it's something that I think is actually very strong in the current environment, is just this kind of casters that either have the personal threat to deal with this, to contribute themselves, even if you have to sacrifice your army to not lose, they can then follow up either going for the caster or, in the case of, like, a melee powerhouse, they can go and try and clean up a really significant chunk of the opponent's army.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but we're talking Butcher 3 at minimum, which is probably the max.
I think it's why I like
Khan Barney 2. Khan Barney 2! You can do it, Barney! Get in there, buddy!
It's why I like Lucas.
Yes, Luke. Yeah.
I think he's an excellent dude who plays the grind out and then accidentally kills you.
Yes.
Or not accidentally, very intentionally, because it has to happen.
But that's the thing.
Sorcerer's usually really good at killing the caster that needs to come forward to win on scenario.
And the thing is, like, you can make it look accidental. Like, oh, it was an accident for insurance.
Why did you put them there?
Why? I just kill her. But that's the thing. It's like, if you know going second, and let's be honest, like, this is telegraphed. If you're going second, you know you're going second. Congratulations. So you can set up the...
Fuck did that just mean? Yeah.
Wow. So insightful.
I know. I'm the best.
And that's why you pay the premium price for Dark Guidance.
We're cutting the podcast here. If you want to hear about how my drunken ramblings, like, pan out, you can listen,
right?
Hear
about the keys to going second.
After you scream their ears off, looking at the sound recording, and Chris is like, solid block of sound.
Such sound bites is, if you're going second, you're not going first.
And you
you're going to know that you're going second. So you need to plan for it.
This yeah. sounds like a bad anime meme.
Oh, yeah. But as a result of that, you know that when you're... You know that you're probably... If you've got a caster that can actually pull an assassination off... Lucas is a good example. You can set it up such that if they do come for the scenario play, however it happens... You can then go for the assassination run.
Yes.
So, for instance, Lucas might go immediately heavily juice up and put, like, Mirage on his arc node.
Yes.
And the intent in there is basically...
My arc node threats the whole board now.
Yes. And your opponent...
Wait. Why are you giving away my tech, Chris?
You're playing McKay. There's no tech involved. Actually, there kind of is. You have to remember to feed before, you know... before shooting. Like,
I can see why Tom would like that faction with just two amazing assassination casters.
Oh, yeah.
Just like, which flavor do I want
to
play?
By the way, I forgot to remind you, you left your deployment zone. I win.
You didn't leave your deployment zone. I actually still win. It's fine. It's still fine.
You're just making me do it over a longer period of time.
Yeah. Yep.
It angers me how good the assassination casters are in Crucible Guard versus the non-existent ones in Krimkin.
Yeah, Colin, Grimkin's pretty short on.
They have some weird justice. Jank, yes. as Colin discovered, but they don't have, like, that guy is going to kill you.
You know who should be a caster in Grimkin? Lord Longfellow. I guarantee if he was a caster. Alright, Will. Look,
a lot better than Kane.
Any Will. Look, Will. Five if you're listening to us, please make Lord Longfellow into either an alternate history caster or just the next Grimkin caster.
Yes. It would then be a case of people wanting to try and find non-character warcasters in their faction.
Or character.
I need a generic Iron Fang caster. This guy's not Sophia. He's just Jim. Yeah. The Iron Fang.
Now he's a character.
Damn it! Damn it, Jim! You had one job!
Damn, he's all to hell.
This is just Corporal Iron Fang.
Corporal Iron Fang. No, we have to make a more assassination type. Corporate Assault Commando! Whoops.
So I think where you were going with that is basically what I was saying earlier, which is you need to recognise going into a game, and sometimes you won't be able to determine what the game is going to look like until after the game has had that first roll for who's going first. But all of the good players that I know have... basically in their head an idea of how a game will play out from the moment that first die roll is rolled. So once that die roll is rolled, you've chosen lists, you've chosen sides, you know who's going first. From that moment forward, most good players know roughly what they think the game will play out like, and they are already starting to plan for how they play against whatever their opponent's primary win condition is. So if your opponent's primary win condition is, I'm going to run a fuck ton of slayers at you, they're going to be 25 inches up the board, and if you can't work out a way to at least get out of your deployment zone and contest, you're going to lose, then you need to already have a plan in your head. And that plan can be, I'm going to sacrifice 3/4 of my army to slayers turn 2 so that I get one shot at Gatsby to win the game. And that's fine. If that's your plan, then all you have to do from that point is work out how to execute that plan and disguise it well enough that the Gatsby player has to still commit.
Is that what happened, Whaley?
That's exactly what happened, yes.
Played for and gotten.
That's exactly what my plan was, except I couldn't win the strength test on the throw.
Shame on you, Bailey. You know what? Having played against that list a couple times, that generally is where it fails.
Yes!
Yeah.
Slayers don't just skip leg day. They also no, they do leg day, but that means they skip arm day.
They're really good runners.
Yeah.
They're like the Usain Bolt of War Machine.
But leaving aside Slayers, I think that's advice for every game. If you're a relatively new player, and I don't know why you would be listening to this podcast if you are, but if you are, congratulations and welcome.
Wow.
There are new players.
Yeah, there are. There are.
I thought War Machine was dead.
I don't know that they hit Dark Guidance before they hit any of the ones that have decent audio and people that are intelligible.
Wow. So, good job, Tom.
I mean, to be fair,
you're so rude.
That's a good review of Australian podcasting.
Plus, I don't know if anyone can actually understand anything you guys say.
Intelligible was the word
yes.
I used.
Yes.
But I was just remarking my ability to edit.
It's just the general, we have 6 people, 2 of them are on Skype talking through a speaker into a microphone, and we're all talking around a table with accents.
Don't look behind the curtain.
Brian, I will say, sorry, Tom, I will say, you do a fantastic job at making something legible out of this podcast.
So
audible, I should say.
I guess where I was going with that is, if you are a new player, or even if you're one of the more experienced players, being able to, before a game, identify what you think that game is going to be about and how you think that game is going to play, and then remembering to compare that with what actually happened when you get either three quarters of the way through or at the end of the game, is a really big skill. Like, being able to see at the start of a game how that game is meant to play out, how that game is intended to play out by your opponent, and how it's intended to play out by you, is probably, in my opinion, about 50% of actually winning a game.
Mm.
If you can get that far... Yeah.
Exactly right. And I think it's an extremely important skill to have, because obviously it gives you the best tools to try to prevent that from happening. So, you know, that initial, like, role play in your head to think, yes, I can see where I'm most likely to lose the game, and therefore, you know, I have to use every ability I have to try to prevent that from happening, and that opens the door for you know, the multiple other possibilities that could happen. You know, inevitably, I could actually win because I have, you know, prevented my opponent from achieving their greatest win condition.
Mm.
And that's a very important skill to learn, I think, moving forward. And it also, just to go one step further too, if you get very familiar with that as well, definitely coupling with the new scenario packet. But you can also, that can also be a tool that can help you in the initial list selection as well.
Yes.
If you can say, look at opponent's lists, you can look at the scenario, and then obviously this determines, you know, your knowledge of the actual game, and coupled with your experience. But if you can see that and say, right, I think my opponent is going to, you know, drop this list because it gives them this win condition, which in turn is very suitable for this scenario, it may give you a little bit of an edge on, you know, what list you're going to play. And again, if you've got the tools to be able to counter that, then and you can identify that, that's definitely going to help you, you know, certainly put you in a better stead to win the game, but more so, you know, a better understanding of the overall game in general. And, you know, moving forward, it's just adding to your collection of experiences and your breadth of knowledge, which in turn hopefully make you a better player.
Yeah, it's the reason why Theory Machine can only get you so far, especially in these kind of matchups. Because here's the thing, when you think about Nine Slayers, in Theory Machine, almost always someone is going to say, oh, well, you can't move forward because then you just get hit by nine combo strikes and a bunch of focus, and then Gatsby feats on top of you, and then you lose. You lose. Good day, sir. But the actual truth of that is, no, if you do it properly, you'll probably be hit by like four Slayers or so, at most, and hopefully in parts of your army that it isn't relevant. And but on the other hand, from the Slayer player's perspective, Whaley, you'd start breaking out the rule for power attacks, and you'll use the power attacks to start trying to win, basically, like, cheese out scenario points you're, quote, not meant to get. All of that you can only get so far, but it is, if you can try and identify just how that is going to work on the table, and it's why reps are so important with these kind of matchups as well, because if you're able to get some reps in against, like, random scenario lists like this, get a much, like, you can, first of all, determine whether the game is even playable. Because a lot of the time, and I'm getting assaulted by a cat.
A lot of time.
Indeed. Anyway, you can determine a lot of the time whether the game is even playable to begin with. Because there are times you'll look at, like, I'm fucked.
Yeah, I'm still at that point with Ostrom, right?
Yeah.
And I think one of the big problems with, like, a list like that,
yes,
and getting reps in, is that
you learn how fucked you are, well, even more.
Right, Nine Slayers, and like Primal Terror is the one that I've had like a fair amount of reps with now, and I feel like moderately comfortable, depending on the pilot playing into, is because the design of that list is fairly rigid. Like,
yes.
You'll have Ogres, you'll have a Blightbringer, might have Trigger Bird, you'll definitely have Hellmounts, whatever.
Yep.
Nine Slayers is exactly as we state, but then you've got like Ostrom, and like it's why I think that, again, I'm just like butthurt by Ostrom right now, if you can't tell. But that just doesn't have a like an archetype build, right? Like there's a few, right? Like there's all the bunnies, there's all the spray bunnies, there's combination of bunnies and toilets. Then you've got all the heavies, then you've got some of the heavies, some of the
lights. Toilets?
The battle engines.
Sure.
Yeah.
They're not Darius. Come on.
Sure.
The siege toilet.
The siege toilet. But like that sort of list, I think, is hard to qualify as to just how dangerous it is as a snipe.
Furthermore,
because you don't know what flavor you're going to get into, and it's hard to then tech to play against it.
Furthermore, and this is very important, especially if someone says, like, I have an Ostrom answer. No, you don't, because you know what the Ostrom player is going to do? They're going to change their Ostrom list, so you no longer have an Ostrom answer.
In a very minimal, like, it doesn't take much
If they go from 8 gun bunnies to 4 spray bunnies, 4 gun bunnies, they now have a Haley 3 answer by accident. And that shit just happens all the time. It's a lot of minimal tweaks. And to be fair, with a lot of good lists, that's actually all it takes. Like, 9 Slayers with, like, with Ironmongers has basically a really good matchup in the high defense, because you've got the curse from the Ironmongers and you can control circles. You then throw in the Necrotex, and all of a sudden you have a completely different random recursion element you've got in your list now.
Ghostfleet back in the day was one of those lists that just had, like, weird tweaks that totally changed how it played. Like, when you saw a jump to having a Wraith and just like, oh my god, how fuck do I deal with this thing? Then it was...
Or cutting the Ghost Pirates, because you're like, well, the matchups where the Ghost Pirate... I'm playing Ghostfleet into the Ghost Pirates aren't actually relevant. I don't need a toilet bowl on someone who can't deal with Ghost Pirates more, because they already couldn't deal with a Wraith Engine or Ghost Cane in the first place.
The Battle Group was, like, the weirdest thing, right? Like, you and I played a bunch of games with Ghostfleet, and, like, you... Like, when we first started playing, you just had the Arknodes as your Battle Group. And then one day, it was just, like, all the only change was one Arknode became a Stalker, and that game became... so unbelievably different.
Yep.
And I think that that's one of the really hard things to sort of qualify in terms of how valuable those reps are in, is actually understanding what the baseline of that list is going to do, and then being able to see those changes, those adjustments, and proactively react to them effectively.
Yeah, so you can't, like, I've seen this too many times, fuck, I'm in an internet discussion involving this already, but you can't get too stuck in Theory Machine with a lot of these lists, because at the end of the day, Theory Machine has no terrain. Theory Machine, you always win or always lose, depending on your mode of play, and if you're playing into Kruger 2. There's certain casters, legitimately, there are certain casters you cannot beat in Theory Machine. They will always find some bullshit out, and obviously that's not how the game actually works, because you involve die and stuff, but it's really...
I've always worked for Morgana.
Yeah. No, I enjoyed that.
In Theory Machine, she was fine. And then in the table, the
she
was fine.
She was also fine.
Yeah. Fine.
What was RFP?
Well, it's all like, you've already killed the RFP, right? That's how it worked, right? They didn't have any RFP because it was already dead.
Yep, it was sweet.
Yep. But yeah, you can't get super stuck in Theory Machine because it's just not productive in some capacities. It's fine to get a rough idea, and just don't get super arrogant about how good your fucking kick-ass list with its crazy combos is. You've got to put in some reps.
Mm.
And you've got to figure out whether, like, you've got to be a bit realistic about it, and especially in this kind of scenario stuff, because you could have a list that legitimately is a fucking ass cruncher, will just destroy all the armor.
Ass cruncher.
Wow. That's a new one. This is
a legitimate ass cruncher.
Is it done with a device? Do you do it with your hands? Is it a leg action?
I think it involves a lot of squats.
Okay.
But yeah, you could have some
ass cruncher 9,000. You could buy it for $59.99.
Free delivery, you can return it in 120 days.
It's free premium content, only available on Dark Guidance. But yeah, you could have a list that can just crush 9 Slayers.
Yes.
It will, on paper, mathematically, destroy 9 Slayers in one turn. And will lose every time, because that's not how the game goes. Your opponent is a real human being and not a robot, and definitely not a robot you're controlling. Your opponent will also hopefully be cognizant of what's going on and be like, I don't want to go into the Ass Crusher 9000. I'm going to go around it.
I'm going to drop Scar.
Oh, yeah. It was just like, I'm just going to drop Scar.
No ass and all rack.
Not just all rack. Great rack.
The greatest rack.
like, one of the things we sort of have touched and also not really gone into much depth on is this idea of gear checking being, like, basically the way to build a list, and it then being, like, your sort of scenario-dominant type of list, and whether or not a scenario-dominant list that we're seeing or that we've seen in the past has effectively just been an elaborate gear check as a strategy. Because I definitely think there are, and I definitely think there aren't. And it's interesting, if we're talking about how to actually construct a list that is gunning for scenario.
For our theoretical newbie players, what does a gear check?
Just, it's a list that is either, like, you can either beat it or you can't. Like your, what you bring is capable of playing into what it has to offer, or it can't.
So it sounds like the basis of a skew list.
Yes. Normally, well, most commonly a gear check will be some format of... If it's not directly skew, it will sort of be skew. Well, so it will
by definition of skew, you're making is a gear check.
Or at least, like, strategy linear.
Yes, but for it to be a true gear check, sure. It's really generally either your defense is super high or your armor is super high,
right?
Or you
have so many boxes or you have so many dudes.
Or so many bodies, yeah. So you've got something that says either... Okay, so if you have so many dudes... If you have so many dudes, then the gear check is, do you have a way to clear dudes, right? Like, if your list is five heavies, then you probably don't have a good way to clear dudes. You're going to lose straight up to that list.
Yep.
Tough, mass tough.
Yeah, if the list is, I have a bucket load of boxes on armor 22... and you don't have power above 14, you failed the gear check, you're not going to get through that list. Yep. Just can't be done.
Yep.
And it doesn't matter whether you outplay it or not, you're probably not capable of winning that
mathematically,
game.
Mathematically, it doesn't work out over the long run.
Mm. Yes, there will be exceptions. There are always exceptions. Yep. There will be some idiot who plays it and does it terribly, and there'll be some guy who's a genius or girl who's a genius and just plays around it and knows a scenario or whatever.
Into it and then just rolls all the spikes. Like, sure. And then reports that that's the way that the game works out, right? Like, it happens all the time.
But at the end of the day, gear checks tend to be things like, for example, Primal Terror's Under Thags is a bit of a gear check. Yep. If you don't have high power attacks, you can't get through Hellmouths.
Yes.
You physically can't get
all the Ogryn themselves.
Yep, all the Ogryn themselves. So,
and if you don't have a high enough gun power, you generally won't be able to attrition that list effectively because it's so high armor in melee.
Yep. And like that, like I found like interesting. Like you talk about the Primal Terrors, its gear check. I found it's not just being able to punch through; it's also being able to avoid the fight long enough.
Yeah,
the longer that army doesn't get to play to fight a battle, the worse it feels like it goes over the course of the game, because it really wants to leverage that trade element.
Yeah, there's a bunch of aspects to Primal Terrors with triple warmongers and how to play into it.
Yeah,
in fact, actually, that's a good point. A lot of gear checks are multi-layered.
Double rot wing.
Under
Callus one out of theme.
Definitely need long chops.
No. Yeah, definitely need long chops.
New hot American tech.
Why is it out of theme?
Why are we playing?
Themes are for chumps.
So, all right, Tom, lay it on us. What's the gear check?
Yeah, please,
sure.
We've got please.
20 rot wings under who?
No, there's a couple of people posting Primal Terrors list with two install rot wings, and when you ask them why, they're like, well, it helps the Ogryn hit things.
How? Plus one
mass. What?
So I could take this one UA that just makes everything minus two.
Is it under Callus 1?
No. There was a thread that got posted on the Legion forums with the picture with all the models except the War Spears, and then people like quickly, like people just immediately jump ship and like, well, War Spear is amazing, especially with these rot wings, and you can make things defense lower and then hit things with...
I don't hate War Spears. I will go on record as saying I think the War Spears are fine.
When they get to make attacks, they kill stuff.
Yes.
Right? Like that, and that's a perfectly viable build for a unit. It doesn't make them bad, just maybe they're not...
They hit like a truck.
Yes.
And they shoot like a truck.
You know what?
Yeah, that's the weird thing. They hit as hard. They shoot as hard as they hit.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. You know what? I'm going to go record. I'm going to stand for the thing. No, War Spears are trash. And you know why? Because they're basically, like, really... they're basically doing something the list already does very well.
Chris opens his mouth, and the whole bar just goes red.
Well, because I was talking about War Spears, to be fair, but but seriously,
something the list already does. You think?
Oh yes, the list already hits hard and punches.
Please stop talking over Whaley, Chris.
So, what does the list do when it has to walk into Rask's feet versus when it has War Spears and it can walk in and throw shit at my stuff?
No, it can't throw stuff anyway because you got the Rask feet also drops
through.
Ratio about five inches, correct.
Well,
which means they have a 10-inch threat instead of a 7-inch threat, which is a significant difference for me.
I mean, for one, if we're playing Hyperbole Machine, it doesn't matter because your models were dragging.
That wasn't hyperbole at all. That was an actual exact example.
No. I'm playing Hyperbole Machine, Hyperbole Machine says that it's okay. I'll just drag something with a helm out. It's fine. Just don't pay any attention.
Sure.
But more realistically, you just sort of wait around because you have more mongers who are incredibly undercosted. Look, I don't particularly like the War Spears because, honestly speaking, they do something the list already hits ridiculously hard.
Yes.
It kind of doesn't need a model to make double attacks because that's not what the list kind of wants. The list wants models that are obnoxious to get stuck into melee with, which is Warmongers and Chosen and Hellmouths.
Yep.
And to be honest, Rotwings. Especially.
Wait, what? Double Rotwings, Chris Davies.
Did we just walk into a world where Rotwings are now officially better than Warspears? Okay.
Yep.
That's all right, Chris. So for Wintercon, I'll bring my 2 units of Murder Virgins. You bring your 2 units of Rotwings, and we'll just fly around the board and have a wonderful time.
No worries. As long as I can borrow your friend's cat. It's fine. As long as I can borrow your friend's Callus 1, therefore I can upgrade my Rotwings into real models. Sure.
I still have a box of Murder Crows sitting on my on my painting table.
I don't hate Murder Crows.
Because Tom bought them and they just never did anything with them.
Do you mean Carrion Thralls?
Whatever they're
called. Yeah, that's different. Murder Crows are in Grimkin and are actually a unit. Yeah. Yeah. Carrion Thralls are in Crix and are not a unit.
That's the one I'm talking about.
They make
about.
Really good basing material.
Yes. I have thought about just using them for that.
Yep.
That's exactly why I own a box of them.
They're probably playable in some lists.
They're fine.
Whaley, have you got a list that has Carrion Thralls in it?
I do. We talked about it. Gorshade 2.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't hate them in Gorshade 2.
They feel the exact same roles as Crab Thralls, except they can do some attacks with Finisher, but then your feet and you kill them all and they become...
and then become so what you're saying is you take them in...
I like how you and me have the same plan for our birds is literally to upgrade them through feet.
Here's the problem with that, Whaley. I have played Gorshade 2 extensively in Mark 2, and I learned that if you plan to get value out of whatever the hell it was you were planning to feet on, inevitably you get it killed before you get to feet on it.
I agree, but only one or two birds going in and doing some finisher and the other eight just sit back behind.
So you get two power 7 weapon master, probably.
You mean power attacks. You mean
two
one
power,
power nine
two
they
power
have
seven, two power nine weapon masters killed their conquest. I told you that story. They were amazing.
Alright, fair enough.
Remember we just said that people just report that things like rolling skew and that's the way to play it?
Two power lines, rolling 24s, killed the crap out of the heavy.
Yes.
You kill them. Look, you got a small window of opportunity. They go in there, they do their work, then you kill them.
It's small really window of opportunity. Very, very, very small window.
It's fair because they don't explode when they kill things like Scrap Thralls do.
Sure.
I can see where Aaron talks, and then where Chris talks, and then where Colin talks. And then where I talk.
Yep.
The graph is just... it's dead.
Anyway, Carrion Thralls. I've got 2 units. I think they're good.
Wait, good?
As the official lover of all things as birds, I approve.
let's backtrack a second here, Whaley. You've given me...
Why play more Carrion Thralls? GG.
You've given me one example where you played them as... the fuel for Gorshade 2's feet. That does not seem like sufficient to then say these are good as a unit.
Well, you know, you've got to use your imagination. I mean, if we want to feed it in, the unit leader can run a long way in my contest zone. That ties into our initial conversation. As long as he doesn't get a free strike and
stop. Whaley, did you invent marketing?
You gotta let it fly.
Imagination.
Repo 5 is pretty handy as well.
Repo 5 seems good.
I think we just established that Carrion Thralls always win in the dojo.
They don't.
They don't.
They never struck me as terrible. They're just only available in a theme that I don't really want them in.
Pretty much. Like, they were back before themes. They were, like, actually in the conversation for one of the better units in Crix because every, like, Mechanic Thralls were garbage, and it was basically, it was Satixus Raiders or Carrion Thralls. And both of them had the advantage of being fast and had Pathfinder baked into them. Like, you know, if they were in a better theme for them, sure. And...
They're birds. They could literally be in any theme because they just fly there and they're show thralls. Up.
Well, if you want to know, like,
sure.
Why?
Sure.
That's why they made Bane Thralls into Bane Warriors. Because they can't be in the Thrall theme.
Bane Fighters, but yeah.
Yes, sure. I get why they're in the Thrall theme, but I can't.
They're not in the Thrall theme.
Who? No, the birds.
Yes,
they're not.
Yes, they are.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. You're confusing me now.
Who's on first?
But they're literally birds. They could literally fly anywhere, so they could literally be in any theme.
That's not how that works.
That is actually how that works. Do you want to even know how stupid...
Wait, then why can't Soul Hunters be in every theme? They run at speed fucking 9. They're a lot faster than birds.
Boats.
And they can go in corp.
Boats.
They're undead. They can run underwater. It doesn't matter. They're not going to drown.
Sea Kings will eat them.
They're undead. They're eating them. They can't even snack them.
They're ghosts.
There is literally no calorific value out of this.
Wrong.
Talk about why all birds are terrible at War Machine.
Rotwings. Rotwings are amazing.
Golab is amazing.
Yeah,
Triggerbird is amazing.
Triggerbird is pretty good.
Yep.
Triggerbird carries all other birds.
If you want ridiculous theme justification nonsense, all right. How are Rotwings in the Ogryn theme? Well, the reason why is it because
Primal Terrors.
Yeah, they're
it's
in
not the Ogryn theme.
Okay,
it's Primal Terrors.
They're in Primal Terrors.
It matters because Primal Terrors is all of the mutant horrible things.
No, what happens is the Ogryn kill people, they eat them, but they leave a bunch of scraps left over. So vultures come and eat the scraps. And because Ogryn also die, they eat the Ogryn scraps as well. And because they're eating the Ogryn scraps, over time, they get blighted.
So why are Hellmounts there?
Because magic.
No, it's because all of the horrible twisted things are in that theme.
That is legitimately why vultures are allowed in
that
theme.
That's what I thought was in that
theme. Can you take grotesques in it?
No, probably not.
No, you can't. There you go.
Or what about the things that explode out of people's bodies when they die?
Incubi.
Yeah, they didn't get to get in any theme.
There you go.
It's not that you mutilated. It's literally the Ogryn
theme. You can take Kallus in that theme.
Why is it called Primal Terrors then?
Because they're a primalistic, like...
It's all
concept.
Tribes,
people. Yeah, exactly. Tribal.
They're cannibal tribal people.
Wait, how does that make it primal terrors?
Call them because they're all primal.
That's why they got a Mat 7 bird instead of a Mat 5 bird. It all makes sense.
That's a frenzy.
Yep. Because he's always angry all the time. He has perma primal.
They have berserk, so it's kind of like primal.
The best kind of primal.
Yep. But no, seriously, like, we're talking about birds. But you can justify any model belonging any theme for any ridiculous reason. PP have done worse. Everyone has done worse.
To be fair, that's the name circle of the griffins are fine.
Birds.
No, bird is the word.
Bird is the word.
Fine.
I think we've used that before.
All right.
Okay.
Tom, please save this podcast. Not you, Tom. Other Tom.
Which Tom?
Tom Wiley or Tom Gwan or Tom...
Hill. Eddie Tom. Tom Hill.
Tom, what?
Revelo.
Well, I was talking to Tom Revelo, but yeah, sure.
What questions have you got left on your three-dimensional Arrow of Doom?
All right.
That now also features a chrysanthemum and a Spartan helmet. And
a las gun, from what I can tell.
A long las?
I'm pretty sure it's a long las.
Yeah, right.
And some wheat.
Yes.
And a hellmouth tentacle. It's a hellmouth tentacle.
It is.
I don't know, it could be.
Alright.
I believe that it's not spiky and primal terry enough.
Yeah.
Could be.
That's a squidgy tentacle that belongs in Children of the Dragon. Inadequately primal.
Yeah.
Can you take the battle engine?
No.
Because that's what that is.
Yeah. There we go.
The other thing that I thought would be interesting to discuss is this concept of how much do we value particular caster archetypes or suite of abilities when we look at actually creating a scenario viable list and approaching a scenario packet. Like, are there going to be particular casters that emerge as dominant types? And I think in the last packet we saw grindy casters. Like all that, like those bully casters really become quite strong, as opposed to like sort of the back end of Mark II, where you saw like control casters were where it was King. At until sorry,
King,
absolutely until sort of the grind element came in. That's sort of like been a long burn, but I think that there's an interesting discussion we had over.
Yeah, I actually think in this case the big one is casters that extend threat ranges,
yes.
especially melee threat ranges.
I think that's almost 100% necessary. Almost.
Well, yeah, like it's how you a get scenario advantage, or alternatively you fight against someone who has scenario advantage.
You have to extend threat range, or you have to. Like, make your guns amazing.
I don't think that you have to extend the range. I think you have to be playing, like, at least a list or a caster that enables an army that can threat the width of a zone.
Yes.
I think that is the base requisite for playing a scenario viable army.
Yeah, the minimal acceptable threat range to be, like, considered at, like, a good level is actually 12 inches. And it is legitimately just because it threatens the entire zone. Yeah. So you can put a model to contest the zone.
Yeah.
And you can guarantee, or rather, like, say top of two, you put models contesting a zone. It doesn't matter what happens where your opponent puts, you can fight them, and you can make attacks against their models.
And it's not necessarily to say that this is to look at a list that just wins on scenario, but I think in order for a list to be, you know, strong at playing the game that utilizes scenario as a method of securing victory,
well,
you need to have that ability to clear a zone at any given moment.
Yeah, to put it in perspective, for a list that doesn't really win on scenario, but is, as I said, it's a kind of list that aggressively not loses on scenario, Winter Guard.
Yeah.
Specifically, like, one of my favorite types of Winter Guard is, like, P. Vlad, and it has a couple of aspects on. Obviously, rifles and rockets have natively high threat range, but the other aspect is that P. Vlad's feat makes their threat range of Warjacks without casting any spells, just 12 inches.
Mm.
The threat of a zone.
Yeah.
And it means that you can... Let's just say you go first, you get advanced move, you can boundless charge the Warjacks forward, you can just basically get them into the zone-ish on turn one.
Mm.
And Kador being what it is, it a lot of times has very, very bursty speed. Like I said, the threat range is 12. That's a complete lie. It's actually 14. And that's the catch, right? You can, if needs be, threat 14. But a lot of times, if you just have a Marauder in a zone, you can just pop the feet and be lazy. Threat 12.
Yeah.
Combo smite anyone out of the zone. Kill a Colossal if you have to. Whatever. That's a kind of, you know...
Casual Colossal removal. Whatever. It's fine. I'm a weapon master. Whatever.
Whatever.
Which cast are we talking about?
P-Vlad.
Does it matter?
Sure.
P-Vlad. We're playing Marauder.
But that's the thing.
No. Most Kato casters have a problem getting a jack reaching more than 12 inches.
It feels like all the good ones are just fine at doing it. Like, you're...
A lot of them will get to 11. 11 is a pretty acceptable number across almost all factions.
It's
like
base speed 4.
Yeah, base speed 4, which means it's hard to get it above 12.
Yeah.
Sure.
But a lot of factions will get to about, like, 11 inches of threat, right? That's pretty acceptable, you could say. But getting it to 12 is when you really start kicking in, because then, like, you can a lot of times exploit positioning when your opponent only threats 11 and they can only contest, they can only basically toe in their zone. Especially if they have something big that they need to put into you, like a Colossal, one of their ones, you can just contest with a heavy, be out of its melee threat range, and be quite comfortable as long as you don't get randomly punted out through, like, a slam gun or something.
Yes.
You should still be fine. That's the kind of positioning games you still be playing. Like, if you just have a high melee threat in the back pocket, like another one, to not do a Kator example for once, Resnik 2, or even just Resnik 1, his ability to take Scourge of Heresy and just have Scourge go on random adventures is really nice to have, even in a list like that would normally otherwise be very, very static, like a lot of Menoth lists. Res 2, especially with his ability to give a boundless charge and curse a model, right? It means that you have a random assassination threat that you just tell people at length.
Yep.
And one of my favorites, a list that I accidentally list I made for a friend of mine, Loke, specifically Loke in Convergence.
Yeah.
Loke has high melee threat across the board, and she has a very inefficient spell called Jackhammer, which sounds silly until you consider that, as one of my friends pointed out, Loke, when Convergence, can cast Jackhammer to get one attack for one focus, or she can allocate three focus and get about, like, 20 attacks out of that three focus. due to it trickling through. And all your threat ranges are generically decent. They're like 9s or 10s or something, about average across the board. And then you have models like diffusers or the ability to run and jackhammer or warpath or redline or anything like that.
Or any combination of any of those abilities.
Yes, and you can unjam using jackhammer and then activate the model and warpath forward and then charge and all that. Like, that's the kind of thing you really... If you really want to push that kind of game, that's what you want to be.
Yes.
So it's not just high threat ranges, although high threat ranges do matter, but also flexibility. Because yes, because sometimes your opponent cannot be charged or cannot be targeted or has some other ridiculous rule that stops you from basically getting to it. I mean, easy example is I remember Frawley playing a game on Wednesday where every turn he was playing Cold Grammar and he put the cannot be targeted ability. Oh, he was playing you, Colin.
Correct.
Shit.
How'd that game go, Colin?
Well, that was awesome.
Here's the problem.
At the end of the day, he actually didn't kill me, but like it was totally a one-sided game.
Yes.
It was Barney 2 walks forward, loses a heavy. Barney 2 walks forward, loses a light. Barney 2 walks forward, loses two lights. Barney 2 walks forward, doesn't die, and thereby wins the game.
Yeah.
Ah.
Cool. Which was just because Frawley had to go home rather than just like sandpaper another layer off. Yeah, okay. So he was like, I guess I try and kill you? All right, sure.
Yeah. It was interesting to see Cold Grammar like one round, two bone swarms.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
was kind of interesting. I hadn't respected it that much until then.
Yeah.
And without mold, too. It was cool.
Path 14 signs of importance is pretty
strong. No, her sprays are good. Really... Yeah. I killed a Roadhog with that, I think, one turn.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was me, too.
Yeah.
Colin, how much do you like Cold Grammar right now?
I've had a lot of good games into Cold Grammar.
Turns out, Rask
plays into Cold Grammar fine. Everything else plays into Cold Grammar fucking terribly.
But if you're playing into Rask, all you need to do is bring bears,
yes.
and then you're fine.
Yes, that's fair.
Thankfully, Cold Grammar can also bring bears.
If she needs to. Did.
Yeah.
Fortunately, this time.
Are you bad in the trolls, Colin?
No, I'm just bad in... Well, actually, you know what?
Kind of.
Yes, I think I am bad into trolls. Rask is fine into trolls. Colin personally is bad into trolls.
Is that your nemesis? That's probably your nemesis, because I feel like you have struggled against trolls in every edition.
It's... Well, so Circle struggled into trolls for all of Mark II. Yep. That was just the way Circle was.
Meltdown was a hard count of the whole
You just
pack.
Couldn't play yeah. Circle into it. But Mark III, Rask plays into trolls perfectly well. I have just done things that have caused me to lose.
Fair.
Shit happens.
We're all guilty of that, Colin.
Yeah, falling for the Madrak Rope-a-Dope 6 or 7 years into your career is a pretty bad move, but what are you going to do?
Yeah.
What's the Madrak Rope-a-Dope?
Oh, look at me.
Oh, look at me. I accidentally triggered your admonition, and now you're enraged to put two heavies on my caster, and I'm only camping one. I guess I'm going to die.
Then not then dying. I didn't die.
That's Madrak. You don't kill Madrak. Don't Correct. Ever kill
That's
Madrak.
That's the Madrak Rope-a-Dope.
Was that against Tim? Was that against Tim?
Banky, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So Tim outplayed you because he gave you that... Because
he accidentally triggered admonition with his second last model moving in his
Accidentally.
Turn.
It was
accidental. But in his mind, he was like, oh shit, now he's going to kill all of my dudes that I carefully put out of his threat range and then feed it on. And I went, ha-ha, I can totally get Madrak. And I couldn't get Madrak.
Right.
I left him on one box. What you going to do?
Well, at least he didn't pass a tough check. That would have been
It's true.
But there was like five...
Tough checks coming home. Yeah, there were a few tough checks before that.
Mm.
It was bad. The first 4 out of 5 were passes. That was ugly.
Ugh. This is Madrak 1?
Yeah.
Yeah,
not
It great.
Wasn't on Madrak. He wasn't toughing.
Oh, okay.
It was toughs on the things that were in the way to make the Swamp Horror pull Madrak to the right spot.
Right, to get beaten on.
Brutal.
But that's a catch, right? It's like
that's Madrak.
Yeah.
Well, particularly now that he has the +2 defense to everybody, so everybody's def 14.
Also the immunity
knocked and
down.
And can't be knocked down. Yeah.
Short put for everyone.
Yeah, it's a bad time.
Yeah, but that's the kind of, like, that as a defensive list, quite good, right?
Yes. So that's a list that you could, if you had to, walk forward into things on the bottom of one and go, all right, I'm going to feat, here I am, and now I get to play scenario next turn.
Yeah. In addition, you can go like, oh no, I've left Madrak a little bit exposed.
Oh no, 3 stars could get to Madrak!
That damage cancelled, that one I'll transfer. Okay, we're done, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. Like, there is something to be said for casters like that. Like, if you look at some of the worst scenario abusers, either right now or in history, one of the worst scenario abusers right now, fucking Osram. Why? Because he can abuse scenario and not die. Because he's hiding behind a toilet. On the turn he's doing it, he's, like, armor 20. in general speaking, he's going to be armor 14 to 6, like 17 base with a bunch of cap. He might have Bullet Dodger on him just to make really hammer the point home. But it's incredibly difficult to get...
Just wait till I play it.
Can't wait, Tom.
You playing Ostrom, you wouldn't stand a chance. You would be bored by turn 2.
Well, no, he'll kill the turn 2 with bunnies.
I don't think he will.
Top of 2, out of the blue, 18 bunnies.
You mean top of 2, grab a brew? Yeah, I could see that happen.
How many bunnies can you
fit? At least 15, right?
At least 15.
Stark and stealth casters just went up.
Mm.
Okay, so just maybe. Getting 15 spray bunnies.
Maybe. It still reaches 14. Even
you do know he can take Reinhold in that list, but yeah, that's fine.
Or a siege engine.
Or a siege engine, yes.
Or spray bunnies.
The best spray bunny.
But yeah, like, let's be honest, like, one of the best scenario views was...
Six? Why do they have bulldozers? Why are they armor 20?
Why do they have energizer?
Why are they begun?
Well, they're not armor 20.
Why do they have
18?
Yes.
Yes.
Still.
That's significantly lower. Let's be honest.
Sure.
Better question, why are they immune to pushes of all kinds?
Yes. Anyway, why rat 6?
One of the better ones,
why
right?
Why do they have powerful shot?
Oh my god, shut
why
up.
Why rat 6? No one else gets rat 6 on a spray.
A Vulcan does. It only happens
when it's a fucking colossal.
Points is that?
It's only 30.
It's about 9 gun bunnies.
It's 35.
Okay, it's only 6 gun bunnies.
Hold on. McKay is also rat 6.
No, she's rat 7, actually.
She's a caster.
Oh, shit. All right.
Tom, have you accidentally...
There's veteran leader Rulik, right?
No.
No. Thank you.
If they add that, that's going to be so tilting. If gun bunnies get bet leader, that's it, I'm out.
How do they even appreciate bet leader? They're war jacks. Anyway.
There would have to be vet leader...
Rulik.
No, I would hope it'd be living Rulik models.
Also, how does Prospera have...
Then it only affects you when Grimkin plays.
You know what? That makes more sense than vet leader Rulik. But anyway, moving on. Oh god, yeah, like one of the best scenario abusers in history was Karchev, and what is the reason why? He could play the same damn game that we were talking about with Ostrom, except that he was even more unkillable, because he was literally a Hyperion with Inviolable Resolve.
Are we just castifying three, are we?
I killed Johan's Karchev the one time I played it in the, what was it, Iron Moot.
How did you kill him?
Were you playing Ron?
With a Primal Force Evil Getterix.
That'll do it.
Yep.
Yeah. How much focus was he camping?
<Every day.
laughs> How much focus? No. How much focus was he camping?
That's a good question.
I'm going to go the answer is low, because the thing is, he probably would have survived that with good camp, like 5 or so, maybe 6.
Yeah, because then
he's 5 he does, and then he takes no damage.
Yeah, and that's the problem. Is
plus
just
plus 2, he takes dust, take 3, takes 4 damage per hit,
I
5 hits,
really
doesn't know.
I play that matchup for whatever reason, because I managed to get a really sweet circle alpha, which never happens. And then you get it back off at Kai's feet.
Oh, was that Kai too?
Yeah.
Nice.
Has to be Kai too.
Yep. But that's the thing, right? One of the...
I miss Kai too.
Me too. She was fun.
I played her a lot in Mark 2.
Same.
Good thing that the living war beasts are dead and never will be good again. And that was the end of the story. Ignore CID. There's no CID.
Dropped them all by 2 points, gave them all Pathfinder, and then increased their speed.
Yeah, and probably increased their power as well. Just casual.
CID is
going to
be real good.
Mat 7. Or Mat 8. Let's just make them Mat 10. Why not?
17 cost. Mat 7 was the talk at Lock and Load. Which is probably reasonable. 17 points is still a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot.
So,
yeah.
That's still more than it's getting runs.
Yeah. It can be Mat 7.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's probably fine.
It does have Berserk, but...
Yeah, but it's 14-17 instead of 13-19/21.
Well, it starts at 13-16.
Have you ever... Okay, listeners, has anyone ever attacked a skin of Mones that's actually been 13-16?
No, it's usually 13-17.
At least. It's usually 13-19.
No, it's usually 13-21.
No, I've attacked 13-19s.
I've only attacked 13-19s when I've had pull on a chain weapon and been able to pull them away from the aura so that I could make them 13-19 so that I could fucking kill them.
I've only played Ryan into Skin and Moon, so I've only ever played into 13-19s.
Yeah.
Did you get enough?
No, you might have played, if you're playing Ron, you might have been playing into 13-17s at some point.
Yeah. Because that's the thing, is like, that easy to kill. Usually either, because most of the Skin and Bones will have one corpse, but have the aura, or have three corpses and be on a merry adventure somewhere well away from the aura. But yeah, like, you've got, basically, you're...
They quite often have three corpses and one aura.
Have you seen the smile on their face? I imagine they're gleeful to be just...
You're right. There are... Yes. You're right,
they're
actually.
Happy to just be around.
Yeah.
They're just like, they're this like is Steve amazing. Yes. Everything about being out here is amazing. I wow. love this world.
Oh my God,
I'm
so much...
I'm in a great place
I have
right
so much skin right now. I am just moaning it up. This is the best I have ever been. I am living my best life.
Yep. Oh my God,
B,
so many walking corpses.
B to Z are all doing great.
No. Oh my God, I just remembered. There was a time where I was packing a bunch of 13, 16 skin and bones. It was the finals of LTC where I killed like four Grimkin heavies and a Balrogin in one turn.
Were they playing the not?
Were they playing Bump in the Night with four skin and bones?
No. So they were playing the Pat Heretic list. And then he run all his heavy into like engage my front line of trenchers with Haley 3. So I got to literally unload my whole army. And
yeah, that would have been 30.
The trencher long gunners kill the Balrogin by themselves. And then.
Could he use it to heal?
No, it must have been 13-17.
It must have been 13-17.
They should have started with a corpse, so they can't not be 13-17.
The only time a skin of Moses is 13-16 is.
You know what? I'm going to just pull us right back, segue, because thank you for mentioning Haley 3. Because I think Haley 3, specifically Haley 3 Gravediggers. Yes, back on top.
What's a topic?
Did we have a topic?
Well,
about 40 minutes.
We did for about.
We had a longer than that. We got it at least.
We got at least about 50 minutes. Okay, but here's the thing. Of all the lists I've thought about, one of the lists that just is tanky, can survive a lot of scenario blitzes. Is generically speaking good even if it goes second, is Haley 3 Gravediggers. And one of the reasons why is just has a lot of things going for it, but it also shows what you kind of need.
Check.
Doesn't also get a plus one to go first?
That's one part of it. First of all, it has plus one to go first. Second part is that it has a lot...
You want to have the Echo down turn two, because it's like going second with Haley is miserable.
It doesn't matter. You
can just do whatever they want, because your caster cannot punish them.
Yeah, it doesn't matter, though, because you wouldn't have punished them on top, bottom of one anyway, because they would have basically moved outside of your threat range. You can put those echoes up. It's garbage, I know that. It doesn't matter.
You want to present a threat of it on top of two, with, like, four Samurais and, like, shoot them with treasure long gunners.
Mm-hmm. But even if you go bottom of two, look, people wouldn't be running to your threat range anyway. The simple fact is, you do actually have a plan. And more importantly, you have board presence, because your model's at least... not freaking on your deployment line.
I don't know. Some of those trencher long gunners are on my deployment line.
Yeah.
That's why you need a victor.
The first and the second turn.
Yep.
After that, I just kind of wing it.
Yeah, but also a lot of those lists, for instance, you can tell why a lot of those lists have stuff like Alexia, because even if they garbage it up and like go second, they still have ways to contest on, like, say, bottom of two. Or they also have ways of casualty recovery if, for instance, someone... they have to move their trenches up, and the trenches all get eaten by slayers or, you know, whatever, really.
All right, I'm pulling us into a new topic for the last 15 minutes.
Okay. Fair enough, Colin. Then. Thank you, Colin.
I've got a shovel. We're digging our way out.
Yeah!
So, for your current pairing,
yeah.
Whatever your current pairing may be, and you'll state it before you say whether or not you think this is true... do you currently consider scenario actively in that pairing? And which of your two lists do you consider to be your scenario list, if any? Or is it both lists, or is it neither list? And I'll go first. I'll go first. I was playing Rask and Maelok. I don't consider either to specifically be a scenario list. Generally speaking, Maelok is a stronger scenario play than Rask, but that's not typically because Rask loses on scenario. Rask holds scenario very well, but doesn't win on scenario very often. So, from my point of view, I was perfectly happy to play Rask all day, and I was perfectly happy to never win a game on scenario if that was how it played. And I did not feel that that was detrimental to me, but that was because my list was built to be able to hold scenario against people that were trying to win it very well. So I had Admonition and Enliven available and a couple of other bits and pieces to try and play that game. to try and stall a game long enough that I could either win the trades or eventually kill their caster.
Hmm. All right.
So I've been playing for the longest time Ryan and Asiri as a pairing. I'd say that Ryan is very similar to Rask in that aspect where, I mean, there are games where a scenario's been a really quick finish the game. But by and large, like, that game usually plays out where I'm from a little bit behind and just designing to, like, hold scenario so that I don't lose while abusing as much of my opponent's army as I can. And then Asiri is fairly similar in terms of, like, very good at holding scenario, getting those sneaky points early and then playing the grind out after sort of removing as much of the opponent's army as I can. So, and that was actively thought about. Like, both those lists needed to be able to play into Spread the Net because I think Rhett as a faction just has some inherent problems in playing Spread the Net.
Yeah. You don't have any way to randomly create models, to my knowledge.
Absolutely not. And nothing really...
And nothing really cheap either.
And nothing really sticks around. Like, there are some pieces that are, like, hard to remove. Like, a polarity-filled Colossal is hard to remove a lot of the time.
But you can't put down the Spread the Net flag, for instance.
You don't want that as your sack piece.
Right, but, I was playing the Vara set of Sirens list for a while, and, like, the goal of that was to basically neutralize scenario, and I just found that list, whilst the things were tanky enough, they weren't fast enough to actually gain that board presence to be relevant.
Yep. All right.
Pass this on to Whaley and Tom.
Very well then, Whaley. Tom. Go for it.
Well, my old list, old pairing, sorry, was Gatsby 3 and Scar 1. The reason I played with the Black Ogryn was to try to be more scenario present of having a scoring unit. So in the situation of if you could win the dial to go first, move so far up to put pressure on your opponent, then you could put even more pressure if you're able to score those three or so scenario points. Scar 1 was probably the opposite in the sense of I wasn't necessarily pushing hard for scenario, but just having those models to deny people scenario. And obviously the ability to create incorporeal machine race off living enemy warrior models to then really slow down their scoring potential, but then obviously that can be a double-edged sword that can allow me to score. But my current pairing, which I'm seriously considering, and I need to check myself because I'm thinking about bringing two battle engine casters, which would be Den 3 and yep. Scar 3.
Nice.
The Denagra.
I approve.
Don't worry, Tom. It's definitely happening. I've just got to work out how I'm going to transport them.
I thought you already worked that part out.
Sorry?
You already worked that part out. You were super confident when you're like, I'm going to crush you with Denny 3. And we're like, how are you getting those there? Like,
no. You've worked it out. You buy them. You buy them in box, and then you assemble and paint them the night before.
Or you just put them on a base.
Yeah.
For all you guys in that room, what I just heard Brian say is that he's going to buy, put together, and paint my models. Did anyone else hear that? I did
definitely hear that.
What did you need, Whaley? For Winnicon? Because I've got one.
Denny 3 and Scar 3.
Denny 3 you'll have to deal with. Scar 3 you'll have to deal with. But I can make a Wraith engine happen. Will that help?
Would it count if we put Scar 1 or 2 model on top of a Wraith engine? Would that be considered?
We get a Sea King that's got a boat on its head,
yeah,
and then we mount Scar 1 on top of it.
Scar 1 and no. Texas models.
I've got it.
I think this is legal.
No. Here's how you make it legal. You take Scar 2, because she's got a hand cannon.
And then you write Bane Lord Osiris on her.
Incorrect. Bus. You get two Revenant cannons, not the crew, just the cannons themselves, because, you know, the ship has two cannons. And then you get three random guys with cutlasses. You know
that's
what, honestly?
Still probably cheaper than buying Scar 3.
Or just get an empty box. Anyway, Whaley, please continue before we get even more off topic.
Yeah, so Scar 3 definitely heavily scenario focused. And Denigra 3 is, again, the opposite. Trying to stop you from scoring while her and her friends shoot your face off.
That's the whole shoot your face off technique.
Yep.
So, but we'll see how we go. If I can transport them okay, which is basically just going to be a whole battle phone bag, which is just Scar 3 and Denny 3, and then the whole rest of the army, I can probably big borrow and steal. We'll go from there.
I like how you've gone for the practical option of not bother borrowing like the battle engines from locals, just borrow literally the every other model. And you know what? You're probably correct.
Which is because those two models are pretty light and they'll travel easy. If that's all I have to bring.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, no, definitely scenario focused with Scar. So it's a pretty nice all rounded list. But I think just the way that it plays, it's pretty heavily focused because obviously it's got a lot of the scoring elements, and Denegra is a little more focused specifically what she does, which is trying to abuse people with mortality, and I've just got a few elements in there to slow down people's scoring. That's my current thought process.
Yep.
Nice. And so, Tom, what deck are you playing in Magic right now?
Is it Colin Wilde?
What'd you say?
Nothing. What's your pairing right now?
It's McKay and then whatever the other guy's name's called. Chris, what's his name?
What, Sylvester?
All right. So it's McKay, is what you're saying.
Okay, so I can answer
this. Fuck scenario, it's assassination.
Lucas?
Yeah, Lucas, yeah.
Okay, right.
Assassination casters.
Yeah, okay, so McKay is actually quite a strong scenario caster because your opponent won't have any models left to contest.
So it's Gristlebrand and Show and Tell, that's what you're telling me?
Yes.
Maybe some Splinter Twin action.
Actually the same list.
Are you speaking English?
They're both in the +2 to go first list. So basically, like, one of the lists is you put clouds up and you put a Mirage Arsenal behind it as far as you can go. The other one is, all right, I'm going to put my whole army across the middle line and then deal with it. I don't know if there's a spot on the board that you can hide from the cave.
You can't, actually. Like,
she can't see through stealth.
She can see through stealth. She has Alice. She 100% can. Worst part, guidance.
She's a misspeaker.
Yeah. And yes, she has flares, so she can help all of her army see through stealth.
What if you can't be targeted, huh?
She has sprays.
What if you can't be targeted by those either?
She can flex her gun to be magical and make you lose in corp if that's the problem.
Yep.
What if you're armor 26?
Well, then she's probably going to run into problems then, Colin.
Actually, she might.
Armor 26 is the top. It's the goal, all right, people.
Not to rain on anyone's parade, but she can just charge you then, feet, and knock you down, and then put that many Weapon Master attacks, initial all of her sprays, and ram you to some weird place. Also, she has bulldoze.
Like I was saying. She does have a lot of elemental typed attacks, which means if you are immune.
What if you're a druid?
There you go.
Before they make the changes to elemental attacks, so they still kill you.
Whoops if she has a Vulcan. Again, not to rain on Heroes Parade, but whoops if she has a Vulcan. Speaking of which, Tom, what's in your list right now?
She's like at 26 inches up the board, and the Vulcan's still like 12 and can't actually shoot anything.
She has mobility, so the Vulcan's actually
super fast.
Well, then she's not at 26 inches up the board.
She actually kind of is.
And she'd go 12.
Yeah, right?
She can't run if she's mobility.
Turn one takes like 10 seconds.
If she's casting mobility, she's not running.
She can charge.
She can actually. What she does is she advances, makes an attack, and then repos forward 3.
Sure. Okay. Same as charging.
Yep. With an attack involved.
But turn one, she's not going to attack anything.
Well, just throw her AoE at something and go.
Skater. Sure. Here you go.
Yeah.
Either way, so she goes. Is she speed 7?
She's speed 8 with mobility, so therefore she's.
So she goes 13 up the board.
Yep.
So she'll be at the 20-inch line if she doesn't run.
No. She goes 14. So she walks 8, repos 3, and then so 14 plus 7, 21. She's 21 up the board.
Seems fine.
What? You just added 8 and 3 and got 14 and then added 7 to it and got 21.
That's bad. That's bad math.
I would like to take that soundbite of Whaley's responses there and use that in every future case in my professional career when people present me with something that is wrong.
That's just bad math.
It is.
Tom, you get a B.
She goes 11. She basically walks 8, repos 3. So add 11 to whatever your deployment zone is. If you get, what is it?
21.
Plus 18.
18.
Yeah, it's 18, unless the 8 doesn't include mobility, in which case then it's 20.
It's 18 altogether.
Okay, so the 8 does include mobility. She's speed 6.
Correct.
Okay, all right, that's fine.
Wow, she was base speeding.
No, she's speed 6.
No, I know. Yeah. I said, wow, if she was speeding.
Well, I assume she was, because people were talking like she was. And I was like, okay, sure. But then people were talking like she was speed 11. And I was like, wait, what the fuck?
Now, what people are doing is, because people can take her in the Magnum Open, Primateria theme, which has +2 inches to deployment. Yeah, sure. Therefore, you're even further up the 20. Team. Yeah.
Sure. And your Vulcan is at 20 as well. Yeah. Much. Maybe a little bit further.
No, it's
19.
What's a Vulcan speed?
No, because it'll go to speed.
Okay, so it's speed 8.
It'll run 16.
Yeah.
So it will be at 23.
Seems fine.
Yeah. But she'll only be at 20, which means that she can't do the fancy you're dead unless you walk quite a bit forward.
Still feels like the Vulcan can make that happen.
Does she have... what's she got? Gunfighter? Or does she have... She doesn't have assault, right?
She's a tank. Assault.
So if she doesn't have assault, then she can only come forward 8 and spray 10. So it's 18 threat. So it's 38, which is your deployment zone.
Yeah. So
as long as you're not directly opposite her, you can walk forward. So
and as long as you don't...
incremental walk forward. But as long as you're not directly opposite, you can definitely walk forward.
Also, if you don't give her a charge target, because then she does get an extra 3 inches bonus. Cause,
as long as she makes it.
Yeah, okay, just, like, don't give her a charge target.
That she can make it to, yes. Yeah.
Mm. Anyway, now that we've derailed the podcast into how McKay defeats Scenario, thank you guys for listening. Does anyone have anything in closing before we derail this podcast with more train talk?
I was thinking about, she used to have
advances,
that's what it was.
Damn it.
She used to, yes.
Thank you, Tom.
Very pertinent, Tom.
Tom, you're literally talking about classes that don't exist.
You spent 2 hours being silent, and then you've just decided to jump on board for McKay's ex-advanced move.
You do know the whole reason they got rid of advanced move was because of McKay, right?
Oh, boy. It's been real.
It's
been a cast. It's probably about as quality as a lot of the other ones. But
I think there were some really good points in there.
There
about
was some
the way
talk about scenario.
There's at least 25 minutes of quality of in Rex.
Yes,
there is.
There is a lot of good quality.
There's a lot of talking over the top of people.
Indeed.
There's a lot of, we've compressed 25 minutes of conversation into 5 minutes because five of us are all speaking at the same time.
We all need to be heard at the same time.
Through no fault of our own, we might have made a good podcast.
There were several faults of all of us.
But faults of our own.
There was no external fault involved. All right.
I'm going to cut this short. Everyone, thank you guys
for... Cutting it short would have been like half an hour ago.
Then just cut half an hour out. Fine, fuck it. Anyway, thank you guys for listening.
The half hour you've got where you've individually recorded each of our microphones, because we have individual microphones, and just lay them end on end, and it will be confusing as fuck.
No, I like this.
Yeah. That'd be awesome. That'd be cool. We should do that sometime.
We should.
Disjointed cast.
Yeah. We'll just get voice mics from all of us. We'll all talk over the top of each other, and then we'll run it as separate audio tracks end on end.
So I know none of us were there for that, but you remember that time where Chris talked about a dead game for like 2 hours with a bunch of other people?
No, I don't remember because I turned it off straight away.
Yeah. If we did the disjointed cast, I think we'd get even more negative feedback.
That was a good cast. And speaking of which, thank you guys for listening to our rambly cast involving 6 people one microphone and...
3 microphones for 6 people, but 4 of them shared one of them.
Indeed. 3 MCs, 1 DJ, 2 microphones rocking on without delay.
And a Tom.
Boom.